The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Jamie Njoku-Goodwin, former advisor to Matt Hancock, the Health Secretary, and now the Chief Executive of UK Music. So this week you've had more good vaccine news, probably the best news yet, in that the Pfizer vaccine has been approved by the UK regulator. It is either heading to the UK or currently in the UK, and needles are going to start going into arms next week. However, for all the talk of a return to normality through the vaccine, figures in government are pushing for caution on the speed of that. We don't have enough Pfizer doses for everyone in the country, and we are yet to hear whether the Oxford vaccine or the Moderna vaccine will be approved. Plus, we still have to work out how we're going to roll it out to everyone and what Simon Stevens, the head of the NHS, has described as the largest vaccination programme they've ever had to entail. So to discuss what we can expect in terms of the vaccine roadmap, and also how we get that route back to normality in the summer, which both Matt Hancock and Boris Johnson have suggested, I am joined by my guest. Jamie, you have obviously been with Matt Hancock quite recently, and you've worked behind the scenes on all the vaccine preparations. How simple is it with this Pfizer vaccine? Because we're already hearing that there is going to be a reduced number of doses in the immediate, just because the logistics are so difficult with the super cold temperature it needs and so forth.
It's interesting. I think partly you need to detach things about in terms of over the next few months and long term, because no one thinks and no one expects that we're going to have full coverage of the vaccination in the next month or so. So a lot of the talk about vaccines, we people need to appreciate and understand that we're not going to be out of this in 1 or 2 months' time. There's still going to be a lot of restrictions you're going to be seeing until you kind of have that vaccine rolled out. There's a number of complexities that different vaccines will be facing. So the Pfizer vaccine, it needs to be stored at slightly colder temperatures than some of the other vaccines, which makes it difficult to be rolling out very, very easily. So there's a huge logistics effort that's being worked on, is being worked on right now to work out how you roll that out. When, and hopefully it'll be soon, but when the Oxford vaccine is approved, that will make things a lot easier because it can be stored at normal temperatures with normal fridges. So it's easier to roll out. But there'll be a huge number of logistical challenges, but government has been working on this. One of the things government started doing right at the very start of this pandemic was look forward to the point where we would have a vaccine and work out how they would be rolling it out. So even though kind of back in February, March, April, it looked like a vaccine might be some way off, there was a lot of thinking that was going into this, trying to work out what you needed to be doing to roll it out, what sort of logistical effort you'd need to make sure that as soon as you did get to this point that we're seemingly at now, when vaccines started to be approved, you wouldn't then have a process that could take years with a normal vaccine of kind of rolling it out, working out who it goes to. A lot of that work and a lot of that preparatory work was done before we even had the vaccine approved, meaning that it should be quicker to roll out than most other vaccines. But it won't be easy, and so it's by no means job done. But again, there's hope that in the early part of 2021, potentially kind of Q2, you can be having vast numbers of the population vaccinated.
James, when it comes to that return to normality that Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock have both touched upon, Matt Hancock this week on the news of Pfizer said that he was confident that, you know, by the summer things would be pretty much back to normal or lots of restrictions would be gone. Boris Johnson has also sounded pretty hopeful, but he does keep trying to urge some caution. So what do you think the realistic sense in government is in terms of how long it's going to take before they can rid, you know, probably most restrictions? And when they're talking about it, what is it contingent on? Do we need more vaccines to be approved?
The biggest single factor here is this Oxford vaccine and whether it's approved by the regulator or not, because the Oxford vaccine solves two problems. The first problem it solves, as Jamie mentioned, is it can basically just be kept at fridge temperature to kind of adapt Jonathan Van Tam. It really is basically a yogurt. You can take it in, take it out, jab people. And so logistically, in terms of kind of taking it to a care home, it's much, much simpler. Taking the Pfizer vaccine to a care home is very difficult because it has to be kept in these very cold temperatures. Once it's been taken out of those, it's very hard to break up the 960 dose crates in which they come. And most care homes aren't of that size. So it's all, you know, all of this is very complicated. The Oxford vaccine is a far simpler logistical product. The second advantage of the Oxford vaccine is the UK has on order of that vaccine enough to vaccinate the entire population. If you could only vaccinate the vulnerable, politicians would come under huge pressure from public health professionals to maintain some sort of set of restrictions for the unimmunised part of the population. So if nobody under 50 had been vaccinated, I think you would see lots of public health people saying, well, there shouldn't be indoor events of more than a certain size with the non-vaccinated population. Once you can vaccinate the whole population, then you are away to the races. And I think you get the moment that Boris Johnson is clearly privately yearning for, when he gets to stand up and say, today I am abolishing all COVID restrictions. And I think that there's two reasons for that. I mean, that's one, his own temperament and personality. Secondly, it is the political pressure he is under. You know, one thing that you consistently hear from Tory MPs who are dissatisfied with the way the government has handled this is, you know, if we're not careful, this is going to be like World War II and rationing. You know, you won't be able to, you know, these restrictions will live on for years afterwards. But we won't be able to get rid of them. And I think Boris Johnson views one of the ways that he reconnects with his party, and particularly that libertarian wing of his party, is to have a moment when he says all of these restrictions go. And I think that's why you had that rare public contretemps this week between Boris Johnson and Jonathan Van Tam in the press conference about how different things would be even once people have been vaccinated.
And Jamie, I want to get on to events and, you know, the steps needed to get to them. And I'll probably have to declare my own interests at that point. But before we do, one of the things I think a lot of people are asking on vaccines is there's been news today that if those who do get the Pfizer vaccine first, which is up to 95% effective, would still have to quarantine if they were a close contact of someone who tested positive for coronavirus. What does this hinge on? Because I think to a lot of people, they probably presumed that would not be the case. But is this about getting a portion of the population, you know, a certain percentage hit, and then it's less of an issue? Is that what is going to allow vaccinated people to not have to self-isolate?
Yeah, so a lot of it depends on this question of what does a vaccine actually do? And actually, it's a question that people will still be answering specifically with these vaccines as we start to roll them out. Because sometimes vaccines, they make it, well, you'll still be able to catch a virus or disease, but it won't be a severe form of it. And so you'll be able to, it'll be just chronic, and it won't kind of like put you in hospital or kill you. Sometimes some vaccines, they may actually stop you transmitting the virus or catching the virus. So even though it would be deadly if you caught it, you're probably not really going to catch it. We'll still be working out exactly what effect this vaccine has as you roll it out across the population. But part of the trouble is that we don't know for sure, and we won't kind of know until we've kind of done a lot more of these sort of clinical studies on it as it's been rolled out at a mass level, exactly what this vaccine will do to you. So you could be vaccinated and it would mean you can't have coronavirus badly, or you can't have coronavirus, but you might still be able to transmit it to other people. And so until we have total clarity on that, and you've got some scientific certainty on that, I assume that's one of the reasons why you'd be having nervousness about allowing people to kind of go out and be doing things. I know ideas of sort of vaccination and immunity certificates have sort of been floated in the past. But so there's still a lot we actually need to learn about these vaccines. And when you bear in mind that coronavirus as a virus didn't actually exist this time last year, around this time last year, especially a vaccine hasn't really kind of existed for many months at all, working out the exact efficacy and effectiveness of these things often takes time.
James, we saw yesterday when Boris Johnson did the people's PMQs, as it has become known, he was asked a question about events next year, and it came from someone in the wedding industry. Now, there are lots of people, I think, quite keen for there to be weddings next year, perhaps someone presenting this podcast who's moved their wedding to the summer after cancelling it during lockdown. But if we're looking at, I suppose, at confidence, because what Boris Johnson said was that he believed that we would be back to pretty much normal weddings by the summer, and he also said that, you know, he hoped that potential customers would have confidence. So do you think the cutoff at the furlough, you know, at the end of March, means that there is something pushing Boris Johnson to relax things to mean that lots of these businesses will be able to operate? Or do you think actually this is still just very contingent on the vaccine?
So I fear that the question of whether I'm at this nuptials or not might be up in the air, depending on how I answer this question.
No pressure.
Right. I personally think that these Tory rebellions against COVID restrictions are getting larger and larger and larger. And therefore, I think if the vaccine rollout goes to plan, I think that Easter is the obvious moment for all of these restrictions to be lifted at once. I also think that, as you say, you know, given that the furlough is coming to an end in March, you know, you need to be able to say to these wedding companies, these events venues, look, you know, you will be able to get back to work, get back to doing what you're doing, you know, from the Easter weekend onwards. And so that would be my strong sense. I think if these restrictions, if we are still talking about the limits on wedding size imposed by the government come the summer, then something has gone very wrong with the rollout of the vaccine. And frankly, the government is in deep political trouble, and not just with you.
Jamie, in your new role, no longer working in the Department of Health, you're obviously working with the music industry. And clearly one of the other things, you know, weddings aside, which is not able to really function the way they used to, are gigs, live music, music festivals. Is there a general sense in the industry that these things will be back next year? What does it look like?
So it's like James said, and actually sometimes you've got to think of the next 6 months as it's not just things getting better. Actually, there's going to be two halves in the next 6 months. It feels like the first 3 months of next year will be quite grim. Bear in mind that January and February are normally the months you have most pressure on the health service. You see NHS kind of sometimes at the point of collapse, and it's not in the middle of a pandemic. And so when you're in the middle of a pandemic, kind of January and February are those months where your health service is normally coming under significant pressure. So January, February, March, I'm sort of anticipating quite tough restrictions and quite tough kind of mood music from government in terms of what to expect in terms of restrictions, social restrictions and economic restrictions. But then, as James said, from April onwards, things start to look a lot more optimistic. And it's been striking hearing how positive and optimistic people from in the Chamber and in the Commons, not just having Boris Johnson, who's sort of, he's always been the optimistic one. I know the joke between the PM and the Health Secretary has sort of always been that Boris is the one that hopes for the best and the Health Secretary is the one that prepares for the worst. Actually, hearing how optimistic some people on the health side are being makes you think, yeah, actually, it sounds like we could be back to some sort of normality come Easter. But the problem for big events industries, and in particular the music industry, is one of planning and certainty. So some sectors might just be able to bounce back at kind of 24 hours notice, or kind of get up and running if they get 24, 40 hours notice. Things like the music industry, things like festivals and big events, I think the sports and theatre will be the same. They often take months and months of planning to make things happen. And actually big music festivals right now are sort of looking at summer 2021, trying to work out if they can be happening. And if they don't have the certainty and the confidence that they can take place, then there could be cancellation of festivals and things in the next kind of month or so, which would be, I mean, it'd be tragic really, because I, again, like James, I'm increasingly confident about what summer 2021 should be looking like in terms of the fight against the virus. And if you look at the combination of where moonshot testing and kind of the rapid developments that are being made in testing, combined with the really optimistic news of the vaccine, it feels like we should be in a much better place come summer 2021 to be able to do things. But we're in danger of that summer being a culturally barren one, lacking a number of events and things, mainly because we did not have the confidence to plan it. And within that, it comes into the insurance issue, which is something that I think is starting to be on some people's radar, but it's an issue that's rapidly coming down the track for major events, which is they're finding it very hard to find insurance for major events in 2021 at the moment. Understandably, given what's happened in the last year, and the insurance industry has taken a massive hit, but it's very hard for organisations and events to be able to insure things that are happening kind of next summer, because insurers don't have that same sort of certainty. I mean, it's one of the reasons that one of the asking to government has been for some sort of indemnity programme or some sort of underwriter of insurance to be able to make sure you can be insuring these major events, because at the moment, we as an industry are finding it very hard to be able to hold them. So it feels like there's a number of things that need to happen for us to have a thriving, bustling summer. I know we've had a push from government in the last few weeks about saving Christmas, but there's also a lot of work that needs to be going on to save summer as well.
James, do you think saving summer is on the mind of the Prime Minister? He won't say himself he plans to get married this summer.
I think it's an interesting question, because I think there'll be a huge amount, not just of pent-up economic demand when the restrictions are eased, but pent-up social demand. I must admit, as I sit out looking out on this kind of wet, grey December day, you know, I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to kind of hopefully getting to Lord's for a test match in the summer with a crowd in. And, you know, I mean, sitting and watching England play India. But I think that one of the interesting things is, how confident the sporting event seemed to be in essentially saying that they're going to go forward, sell tickets to the public. You know, cricket's already saying that, you know, the test match ballots will open. I wondered why, slightly at the risk of usurping your role, Katie, I wondered slightly why are the sporting events so much more confident than the music industry? Is it because the TV revenue means that the ticket revenue from the crowd is just an optional extra?
Jamie, I'm going to pass that question to you in my role as the middleman.
Thank you. And you're doing a wonderful job as a middleman and moderator, Katie. Music festivals and large music events are essentially completely reliant on audiences for their revenue. Also sponsorship, audiences and merchandise are the big ones, but they only come if you've got kind of full audiences. You can't kind of do these events viably with an empty audience. And so lots of sports events can have confidence in planning events because they know that even if they do have limitations or capacity restrictions, they can still do things in an economically viable way. Whereas for the music industry, particularly when you work to very tight margins in the live music industry and in the live events industry, the margins are so tight that any sort of capacity restrictions can be economically ruinous. But it's interesting, a lot of other countries are also sort of, I think, grappling with this and looking at this. So, I mean, one, you look at Japan has just come out in the last couple of days setting out what it expects its Olympics to be looking like and saying you'd have these restrictions or those restrictions, but they've actually kind of set it out. Austria has introduced a €300 million umbrella scheme, which is essentially underwriting and backing promoters and concerts to take place and essentially saying that if they have to be cancelled, the government will underwrite those losses. And it feels like a number of countries are looking right now at how do they make sure events can be happening next year, because there's a big kind of international reputational benefit to it. Every country is fighting this virus. Every country wants to be seen to be bouncing back. And I think it's key for the UK to be showing that it could be getting back to normality in some way, and holding big mass events is one of the big ways we can potentially do that. And seeing as James threw a question at me, I was going to throw one back at James, because this question of pent-up demand is really interesting. And one of the questions I've got with the music industry, and we're kind of considering carefully, is what is the post-pandemic landscape actually going to look like? Because I do remember this time 6 months ago when a lot of the conversation was just, we need to get hospitality open up again, kind of bars, pubs and restaurants opened. And I remember kind of walking through Soho really eerily, all these places were open and actually people weren't really going. There was actually a bit of a demand problem. And it wasn't just the fact that there wasn't the appetite from people, it was also the fact that people were still working at home, so people weren't based in the city centre. Working patterns has changed, and so the whole sort of landscape of things was looking different. Now, hopefully, post-pandemic, when there's actually an end point to the pandemic, you can tell people, look, everyone's been vaccinated, you're able to do these events, you can do these things safely, hopefully things will just go back to the way they were before. But there is the question, it's interesting to actually consider, are there things that will be different post-pandemic? Are there things that will be impacting us as an events industry and the hospitality industry too? Because I know lots of people are sort of hoping that things will just go back to the way they were before. And I don't know, James, do you think it'll be the same, or do you think there'll be a number of kind of disruptive differences and impacts that we'll be seeing the impact of?
So the first thing I would note is I think that it's worth looking at the difference between the first lockdown and the second lockdown. I remember walking back home the night before the first lockdown came into effect, and the restaurants and the pubs were already empty. People had locked themselves down before the government formally did so. I remember walking back home the night before the second lockdown started, and every restaurant I walked past was crowded. People were actively saying, well, if we're not going to be able to go out again for a while, I want one last night out. I mean, that's a change in attitude. The second thing I think is the vaccine makes a really big difference, because I think the vaccine will give people the confidence to go out. And I think that people want to have those experiences again. I mean, people want to have the experience of being with friends and family, going to events. I also think, and this is a kind of distributional issue, which we maybe get onto in another podcast, the potentially K-shaped recovery. I also think that at the higher end of the market, the data suggests that kind of upper middle class households have actually saved quite a lot of money during this crisis. They didn't go on a foreign holiday in the summer. They've gone out less. And I think there are lots of those will be treating themselves to more cultural events and things like that than they otherwise would have done. I also think there will be a public spirited desire to save places. I think there'll be a kind of slightly ironic moment where lots of people who haven't been to their local music venue or their local pub in ages and wouldn't normally go will go in a kind of public spirited way to try and keep the place alive. And so I think one of the things the government needs to think about is look at how successful Eat Out to Help Out was as a scheme. What can you do for the events industry and the creative industries that are similar to that? We know that there is talking in government about some scheme for theatres. I mean, that's an interesting idea. You know, what can you do to create a national mood where everyone wants to go to this stuff? And I mean, that is a challenge for the government, because I also think it's worth remembering this, which is not to bring every single subject back to Brexit, but one of the things that is the City of London's great strength is it is, frankly, a place where people in banking and other financial services want to live. And one of the reasons they want to live here is, and I don't mean this is a chauvinistic boast, I think London probably has one of the best, if not the best, cultural scene in Europe. I think it certainly has a better cultural scene than Frankfurt, which is probably its most obvious rival in financial services terms. And if you lose, or if you see all the performing arts venues in London shutting down, then I think that will have a knock-on effect on the desirability of being in London. You know, if we're all going to live our lives on Zoom and never go out in the evening, why be in London rather than somewhere else? And so I think, you know, in terms of maintaining the City of London's position, keeping our creative industries going is a big part of that. I think you have to look at the whole ecosystem that supports the economy rather than taking a very narrow analysis of, you know, sector by sector by sector.
Totally. It's been one of the things that's been most striking for me in the past kind of weeks and months since I started this new job is hearing the number of sectors that actually rely on events in a way that people don't really realise. So the number of bars and pubs that sort of say to me, one of the things we've really been missing is live concerts, live events, live theatre, because it impacts our footfall. The number of taxi companies that basically have sort of are being close to going out of business because they basically make most of their money from ferrying people from train station to major stadiums for big events. The hospitality, there's a whole number of them that actually is a key part of the ecosystem. And it's, you're totally right, because it's not just actually about, and it's not just about the economic revival, it's actually about the sort of the cultural national revival and regeneration post this pandemic. One of the conversations we sort of probably should have been having as a country in the past year, but haven't done because of everything that's been going on, actually is in the 2020s, in this decade, where actually is the UK going to be focusing its efforts? Where are we going to be succeeding sort of as a country internationally? Because 10 years ago, we had that same sort of conversation, and I think the decision was tech. We want to be doing a lot of stuff on tech. We want to make the UK the home, the global home of tech and this huge kind of boom in tech. And we did a load of brilliant things. Actually, there's a real argument now for saying, okay, post-pandemic, post-Brexit, new decade, where do we want to really be succeeding as a country? And when you look at it, the creative industries and cultural industries, there's a really powerful argument for those being some of the sectors we look at as a country and say, actually, we are a global leader in these things. There's a huge economic and also social benefit to supporting and promoting these and doing everything we can to make sure that they are still up and running. Because I do sort of think that, particularly the music industry, it can be a key part of the post-pandemic economic and cultural revival and recovery. And I think the challenge for us as an industry and also the challenge for government is to make sure that when it does come to that recovery period, we're ready to help drive that recovery.
Thank you, Jamie. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.